Hello everyone, welcome back to Blood Rituals. I'm your host, Nicole Fernandez, and today I literally have nothing else to talk about besides our topic because it is so fucking awesome. Today, we are going to be talking about necromancy! So if you've ever wanted to reanimate the dead on a kitchen table, just like Barbara and Adam were in Beetlejuice, now is the time. I'm so excited to talk about necromancy. First of all, one of the main reasons I was inspired to do this series wasn't because of a scene of necromancy on TV. It was actually because I watched the movie Zombie from 1970 or whatever. It was horribly done, but in all the best ways. Mainly because all the zombies were like, their faces were all falling apart and all the actresses were just horrible and all the dialogue was written by like a third grader. But it inspired me because it had the undead. And this whole entire series, we're taking a short break from Japanese mythology and segueing into the Back to Life series, where we basically study different ways to bring corpses back to life or spirits back to life, or simply talking about how to communicate with the dead as well. So let's jump right in. Necromancy is one of the oldest, most ancient practices in the entire world, well-renowned and spread by magicians such as Eliphas Levi, Pierre Christian, and Aleister Crowley. This practice is one surrounded with layers of ambiguity and negative connotations. It has roots in a number of religions, but necromancy is commonly associated with shamanism and Christianity. Since the Middle Ages, necromancy has been associated with demon summoning and black magic, when it was previously known to be the practice that encompassed much more than those characteristics alone. This practice is meant for the purpose of divination, discovering hidden knowledge from the other world, imparting the means to foretell future events, and to bring someone back from the dead, simply to like get information or to use the dead as a weapon against somebody else. The evocation of a spirit can be done with the body of the individual or by having a piece of the individual's flesh, such as a hand or, you know, literally just like using a spoon, like just taking a spoonful of their flesh and like taking it back to your cave. I'm not exactly sure if that's like all you need. You might need like a specific mass, like you might want to bring a scale with you, but either way, it might be safer to bring the entire body since you're already going into somebody's grave. The term necromancy is derived from the Latin word necromantia. The Greek meaning is a combination of the terms nekros, which means dead body, and mantia, which means prophecy. This is where the difference lies between necromancy and a seance, because the two seem very similar because people are surrounding a table or they're in an actual graveyard or whatever doing their ritual. But whenever it comes to necromancy, the element of fortune telling is the only thing that separates it from a seance because, well, outside of the actual body being resurrected, but as we saw in Beetlejuice, there are cases of seances where the apparition of the ghost is visible in front of us. So the biggest difference between necromancy and a seance in terms of like being defined in a dictionary, I guess, would be that a seance does not give you any clarity or like hidden knowledge, if that makes sense, whenever it comes to the future. The dead that are brought back are called operative spirits or spirits of divination, simply due to the fact that these spirits are being brought forth under the guise of someone's control that is outside of the spirit itself. And for this reason, bringing forth the spirit of a person must be done according to the various tenets of their relation to the person doing the ceremony, as well as the circumstances under which the individual passed onto the other life. Necromancy ceremonies stretch far and wide, with intentions to simply communicate with infernal or familiar spirits, to communicate with someone who has committed suicide, and going as far as to actually find hidden treasure of a spirit that has passed on, or possibly conjuring the like an ancient evil god that is supposed to rain terror on mankind. And you'll see later in this presentation, basically, that a lot of the texts give information on how to evoke gods in particular. And we'll see why that is later on, as opposed to only focusing to dead bodies and dead spirits that were human on Earth. Typically, necromancy follows the writings of ancient grimoires that hold demonic evocations meant to bring forth not only the dead, but angels as well. Because for a period of time, it was lawful for mages to practice necromancy to conjure and compel devils, but it was illegal for the mages to actually resurrect anybody that was like living on Earth. They had to leave the dead to their rest. Many of those of the right-hand path practice white magic and still utilize the practice of necromancy for the sake of communicating with spirits, only for a short period of time, and they're laid to rest immediately afterwards. And you'll see later on that laying the body to rest after any ritual is important, but in terms of white magic, they do take special precaution and care to make sure that the soul knows that they're being laid to rest. But for this reason, enslaving souls for an extended period of time is impossible for the same reason an unwilled possession is impossible. One would have to be able to split the consciousness from its etheric body only if the desired target consents before death, which would break fundamental rules of the macrocosm. This in turn would allow the dead to keep living only on a temporary basis, but just like many users on Reddit, try to make an argument out of, to what use? Why would you do this? There's no point to bring the dead completely back to life, essentially like resurrecting them in the form of a zombie, just for a short period of time. There are many ways to do necromancy, but this in particular, just enslaving the soul for an extended period of time that's unnecessary, is completely temporary. And it does run the risk of actually putting the necromancer in the ground and killing them. Because, like we'll see later on, if a necromancer leaves the circle of protection for any reason during the ritual, they run the risk of having their soul basically obliterated and their body taken over by the soul that is being summoned. By using this dark practice, it inherently develops relationships with souls due to the intention to understand to understand what's going on beyond the quote-unquote final curtain from the dead's point of view. And that varies from soul to soul. Though this communication with the dead can be telepathic or by way of your astral body, it's more common and it's not as weird to speak verbally to the dead, because telepathic communication is often confused in the practitioner's mind as being internal dialogue. So speaking out loud definitely helps the practitioner know when they're speaking with the spirit directly, because the voice will come out in the form of a voice to the practitioner as well whenever it comes from the spirit. So there is an amazing post on Reddit by a user named MindMaster64. He comments on a thread about necromancy, and he basically states that the recently deceased are still greatly attached to their bodies. And I quote from him, "Many of the Christian religions teach their people that they wait in their coffin until Jesus comes. And I sort of make it a sport to educate the poor folks about what's really going on so they can stop hanging around in their box. Atheists are often unreachable as they believe they were snuffed out, putting them in a state of eternal sleep and conscious deviation from the outside world." So in essence, whenever you do talk out loud in a graveyard, you could potentially be speaking to a bunch of people just sitting in their coffins thinking that you're Jesus, or thinking that they're dreaming, or just simply like beings that are in their like coffins, just like not sure where to go. That's the other thing that's ambiguous about this whole entire realm, is that the spirits that are being communicated with have different legends surrounding them. So these ghosts, like this Reddit user talking about spirits being in their coffin until Jesus comes, this is basically the common line of thought whenever it comes to shamanism, and not really just shamanism, but with witchcraft as well, that the spirits of the dead are much more accessible than we believe them to be, because they still have a connection to Earth. due to the fact that they were born on Earth and they lived on Earth, as opposed to infernal spirits, which have always resided in another realm. But either way, getting back to the calling forth of these spirits, early necromancy was possibly related to shamanism alone, because whenever they called forth spirits, such as like beckoning the ghosts of the ancestors of the individual that's like trying to bring the dead back to life, classical necromancers address the dead in a mixture of high-pitched squeaking and low droning. And this is typical of shamans, and it's comparable to their trance state mutterings, sort of just like
namo namo vrikshebhyo harikeshebhyo pashunam padaye.
Like, I don't really know how to like reenact it. It just like makes me want to tickle myself and be like, ah! But you know what I mean? Those loud noises are supposed to beckon the dead as well. So if you just go out into a graveyard and you have a seizure also, you might accidentally summon the dead that way as well. But to be more clear, and if you're being a little more forward thinking about your ritual, you might want to know the following information. Necromantic rituals vary greatly, many of which are popular to the practice beneath the light of a full moon. It is said that the hours of the sun, Jupiter, and Venus are favorable both to ordinary and extraordinary experiments, especially those in their planetary hour. And those of the moon are especially suited to the conjuration of spirits, works of necromancy, and the finding of stolen or valuable goods. And this is a function of necromancy alongside the realm of future telling, all of which will be functional only when the luminary and terrestrial signs are in line. Days that, you know, the moon and all these planets aren't in line, a good rule of thumb is just basically making sure that the moon is out, but there is an official mathematic equation that you could use. They do say that a good rule of thumb is like making sure that the moon is 3 degrees away from the sun, I believe. I don't know how you're going to measure that, but if that helps, I fucking hope that I made your day. So, outside of the cosmic forces needing to be aligned, there are days of preparation needed before the ritual. So, before actually summoning the dead, the necromancer needs to do a bunch of things to prepare for that. They need to meditate on the dead, basically trying hard to understand or know them, like their intentions while they were living, their dreams, things that really mattered to them while they were alive, in order to recite the incantation during the ritual with the true image of the dead in their minds. The magician is also known to eat food associated with death, such as like the flesh of dogs or any other dead animal, black bread, and beverages such as unfermented grape juice. And I believe the black bread and the grape juice are both supposed to be mockeries of the Christian religion, since, you know, Jesus gives bread and wine. Instead, doing any sort of symbolism that mocks traditional Christianity or Catholicism adds to the actual practice of necromancy, because necromancy is basically a reverse exorcism. It's very, very close to an exorcism, but you're not necessarily bringing the dead out of a living body. You're bringing the dead into a dead body. So it's like, it's a contradiction more than anything, but the idea itself is kind of understandable, being a reverse exorcism, considering the spirit is being called forth from, like, the afterworld or from hell. And it was said in medieval times, the body of a corpse is also on the menu. You can utilize the blood and the flesh of a living or sacrificed being, whether it be an animal or a human. And according to a user on Reddit, the use of the dead's ashes also work, especially in terms of white magic rituals, if you're just trying to communicate with the dead instead of you know, using them to hunt down your ex-boyfriend and murder them with a fucking axe. But even then, if that fucking spirit went out to hunt your boyfriend with an axe, it would be temporary. So, just use your brain, people. The retrieval of the dead's clothing is also a popular tradition in necromancy, requiring that the magician rob the grave of the corpse's clothing, wear these garments for a period of time without removing them once, all the while meditating on the dead's life and the ritual to come. Though the ballsy magician who robs graves for human remains is far and few in between, this is not discouraged whatsoever in the practice of necromancy. Some has gone as far as to actually commit murder out of their perverse magical pursuits, though this is a very rare occurrence. But it isn't strange for necromancers to at least seek out bodies that are freshly dead, or died a premature death, or a violent death. The reason being that these bodies are thought to have some sort of vitality that other corpses lack due to their life being taken from their bodies abruptly, or in the same manner, just being freshly dead, so still being linked to their physical body for a period of time. Necromancers protect themselves from the wrath of the dead by performing their rites within magical circles and wearing amulets. One of the most famous amulets would be the Pentacle of Solomon, worn either on the hand or the heart of the practitioner. And it is also said that necromancers are thought to have an immensely powerful mind, not because the mind itself can communicate with the dead, but because they're capable of channeling a huge amount of energy, which results in an incredible strain on the mind and excruciating physical pain. Though necromancers are used to doing these sort of things, that's what makes them so strong. And the idea is, whenever you draw huge amounts of energy over time, just the practice of doing that over and over again builds a type of threshold. And once you start having a high tolerance for this sort of thing, it's easier to fuse different mental capabilities into your practice as well. So this is actually expressed even further when Odysseus travels to the sphere of death, because there's a reference to the power of necromancers who, until the 18th century, were classified only as shamans. And like we mentioned before, early shamanism was associated with early necromancy because this is when people called upon literally just the ghosts of their ancestors, a practice that stems from religions in ancient Sumer and Egypt, as well as Babylonia, Etruria, mainly all of Mesopotamia. And this lasted for centuries, like forever. Necromancy is still present now, but during this period of time in ancient Mesopotamia, necromancy was used almost all the time because at the time, even though it was a little dangerous, it wasn't notorious like it is now. So the dangers associated with necromancy weren't common. It was basically used to connect with the dead, like we talked about earlier, just to see the future or to get some solace on a situation or to possibly get some knowledge about a missing artifact or whatnot that the family needs. The influence of necromancy had its hand in forming a lot of cultish religions, also inspiring rites later performed in paganism, which is a religion whose gods required sacrificial blood for certain spells to be effective. Not every god, obviously, and not every spell either. It's just that if the spell asks for blood, you better have it or else it won't work. And there is evidence of necromancy in nearly every culture, though it mostly surfaces in the form of laws strictly forbidding the practice due to recognition by governments and churches in almost every culture. For example, in Elizabethan England, necromancy was outlawed by the Witchcraft Act of 1604, and this was condemned necromancy was condemned by the Catholic Church because they believed it was the agency of evil spirits. And even Christian opponents of necromancy would argue that the dead were summoned and they were demons that were just masquerading as the dead. And, even further, it was stated in one of Leonardo da Vinci's notebooks that Of all human opinions that is to be reputed, the most foolish, which deals with the belief in necromancy, the sister of alchemy, which gives birth to simple and natural things. Like, you know, necromancy gave birth to something that was not supposed to have birth, you know, which is death. Death should not have any sense of rebirth unless it's in The Hero's Journey from Joseph Campbell. And that's essentially what the Christian church, the Catholic church, even what Leonardo da Vinci is trying to get across here, is that it isn't natural. And even then, the rebirth with Joseph Campbell is completely literary, it's symbolic, it's not real. Even though necromancy is not permanent, the act itself is real enough to be sinister in the church's eyes. And it wasn't just like the Christian church and the Catholic church. In ancient Greece, Plato was also documented to have like horrible ideas towards necromancy. He thought it was illogical and dangerous, but he also, interestingly enough, believed that magic isn't good or bad by itself. He was skeptical but agnostic towards magic, but he strongly discouraged the use of it in Greece. In fact, necromancy was outlawed in ancient Greece for a period of time, becoming completely illegal, and it had to be practiced in secrecy. Because of this, and like, this is my favorite part of this entire thing, because of this, it influenced a whole bunch of people who practiced necromancy to build necromantians, which are ancient temples dedicated to the god of the underworld, Hades, and his consort, the goddess Persephone. And the ancient Greeks believed that while bodies of the dead decayed in the earth, their souls would be released and travel to the underworld via fissures of the earth. The spirits of the dead were said to possess abilities that the living did not have, including, obviously, the power to tell the future, but the temples were therefore erected in places that are thought to be entrances to the underworld because of those special powers. Without these temples being at the entrance of the underworld, it's possible that, like, practicing necromancy, communicating with dead, and receiving prophecies would not be a thing. Because just like paganism, the Greeks followed ritual very strictly. So if something fell out of line, it could potentially make the entire motive, or like basically it could make the results of the ritual null and void. There are some extravagant cases of necromancy in history, which are displayed mainly by, you know, ancient cultures and literature. For example, Jewish and Syrian surgeons used to kill children, twist their neck, and cut off their head. And then they would salt and embalm the head on a plate of gold, which was engraved with the spirit or deity's name that they wanted to talk to. This was their extravagant mode of going about necromancy. And my personal opinion is, I think that's fucking awesome. So that one detail about, you know, the head being cut off is from the Grimoire Morsoth, also known as the Book of the Dead. Another chapter of this book goes into depth about explaining how many criminals executed for their crimes were prime targets for necromancers, because even though they had, like, some of them had family, most of these criminals did not. And because of that, their spirits were often believed to be restless and they wandered the earth, and they were easily called upon because of that one fact, that they were just often wandering and lost and didn't have like much solace in the afterlife. And not only that, Odysseus was said to have brought the dead back to life by spilling the blood of sacrificed beasts into a trench in the ground, and then he compelled the spirits to speak by holding the sword in the blood of the sacrificed creatures and evoking the creatures forth by just calling to them. And the idea behind this is that spirits are vulnerable to cold steel. So Odysseus holding the sword and having, you know, the blood on the tip of the blade basically helps the spirits from coming into full fruition, but it makes the spirits alive enough to talk to them about, you know, his moral quandaries. Other cases are also provided in the book removed from the Bible's Old Testament, It's called the Book of Enoch, but it also surfaces in the Dead Sea Scrolls. You can find either of these in your, what is it, in your library database if you go to college right now. I just looked through the reference pages that gave the encyclopedias for these texts. So if you want to go ahead and take a look at those, go ahead. I would definitely recommend it. It was super fun because this Book of Enoch doesn't just talk about necromancy. It tells tales about giants and the return of our sweet, sweet Lord and Savior, Satan. Obviously, this was all grounds for the Catholic Church to strip the Book of Enoch from their official doctrine after only a few centuries of being in print before the 10th century. However, this text does exist, and I strongly recommend you get into a pursuit of finding this shit, because it took me a while whenever I didn't have the actual databases with me. So if you don't have access to a college database, I'm sorry, but seriously, just fucking find this book. Like, last podcast on the left did a whole episode on giants, and they referenced this book, and I was just amazed that so much could be taken out of the Old Testament that's actually fucking cool. So some common questions that come up when summoning the dead include the following. Like, does the soul come with the body when it's brought back every time? Or can it get lost in purgatory like with Sabrina and her boyfriend? How long does the body stay reanimated? Is it only for a few minutes? Is it for a few hours? Can they stay alive for a couple days? And also, can someone be retrieved from purgatory by way of necromancy? And in regards to all of these questions, I have a few answers. I'm not sure if they're going to be satisfactory, but I do have a few answers based on, like, all of the research me and my friends were doing. So far, it seems as if the whole lost in purgatory concept might only apply to those individuals who are not summoned correctly, though that's a really rare occurrence and typically will not happen unless the intent is intentional to bring that spirit to purgatory, which is also a completely different rite and a different ritual. So again, it's very rare for this to actually happen and be successful. Typically, the body stays reanimated only for a short period of time. So there's no specific amount of time that I've seen, but from what I can kind of surmise, the dead, they're only reanimated for a few minutes, like at most maybe 10 minutes. And the link between necromancy and purgatory is really unclear. Retrieving someone from purgatory is a completely different story. So we'll have to get to that in another episode, because purgatory in itself is just a completely different realm that has way too much to state in this one episode. But the most important thing that the practitioner needs to remember is that in order to summon spirits, there's only like one of two ways you can actually raise the corpse itself. And the most common kind is conjuring the spirit of the corpse instead of it being, you know, the actual corpse rising off the ground. The corpse itself is needed in order to do this, or pieces of flesh, stuff like that, like we mentioned earlier. But in order to successfully bring a corpse back to life, one really does have to have thorough knowledge about the individual. Without having any recognition of their absolute truth while living, it's really hard to connect with that individual because you're somewhat a stranger in that regard. And it goes for infernal spirits as well. Whenever you bring forth some sort of like deity or ancient god, you have to have knowledge of their name and what their legend is. You can't just call them forth because you know their name. You actually have to know the spirit that you're bringing forth, or else there's no real connection between you and the spirit that's being made. Because if you think about it, whenever you're creating a relationship outside of necromancy with a normal person, maybe a lady or a nice young man, whenever you're having these relations, you don't necessarily jump into that relationship and just become their boyfriend as soon as you look them in the eye. There's a sort of give and take and a knowledge process that goes with that. You learn about the individual, you get closer with them, and because of that bond, that's what connects you, as, you know, that's what makes a relationship, is that bond itself being made between the two individuals connecting over one another. And since the dead cannot connect with us directly, it's our duty as living to connect with their life, even if it's not here anymore, as much as we possibly can to make a connection as genuine as possible. Here are some popular books that a lot of necromancers use whenever they're practicing. Even though these are very popular, I do want to preface this by saying I do not condone the actual practice of necromancy. Like, it's fun to talk about, it's super cool to explore, but if you end up buying one of these books and say that I instructed you, I just want to say publicly over this podcast that I am not saying to buy these books. I'm just saying that if you want to learn more about necromancy and if you want to know the actual rituals for academic purposes, here are a few books that might actually help you as opposed to giving you some false information to scare you. So the first book I found was called The Munich Manual of Demonic Magic. This is also called The Necromancer's Manual, and it's a grimoire that dates back all the way to 15th century Germany. A German physician who wanted to produce a source book dedicated to evoking the spirits created this manual that contains three major kinds of magic found in grimoires, which is illusionist magic, psychological magic, and divinatory magic. Just in case you're unaware, illusionist spells are meant to fool people into seeing things like, you know, seeing the fucking boogeyman right in front of you, or like an image of your dad whenever you're like in the middle of like trying to slay someone, and then, you know, the person you're slaying turns into your dad. That's an illusionary spell. And whenever it comes to psychological spells, those basically just like, they're meant to leverage emotional or political power over people by controlling their thoughts. And this is sort of like a telepathy sort of thing. Whenever it comes to divinatory actions or magic in that regard, they're intended to help the practitioner get information from divinatory sources about the future or past. And the Munich Manual contains passages that describe sacrificing mythological creatures. But the craziest part about this book is that it doesn't mention any like biblical or holy figures whatsoever. It only focuses on dark magic. So if you're a left-hand path type of person, I strongly recommend taking a look at the Munich Manual because it seems pretty badass. Next, we have the Heptamerion, which is also called 7 Days. It's written by Pietro di Bono, and the book was written under the belief of planetary magic, which basically means that this individual thought that he can conjure angels for the 7 days of the week. And interesting thing about this author is that he was sent to prison under the guise of atheism, which is obviously not true. And all the while, he was sitting in his cell just summoning the strength to conjure angels. It's pretty fucking cool. And this mirrors the situation where Socrates went to trial and eventually got executed under the guise of teaching atheists or blasphemous ideals, when really his entire life was centered around the gods. Like, Socrates went to the Oracle of Delphi, and that's where the gods ended up telling him, you know, you are the wisest man in the whole entire world, and he didn't believe it, so he sought his entire life. He ended up searching for somebody wiser than him, according to the gods, and basically his entire life was centered around this expedition that started with the Oracle of Delphi. And whenever he went on trial, that's what he ended up telling them, and he still ended up getting executed. So really, this isn't abnormal during this time period in ancient civilizations, because what's seen as atheist or blasphemous is not so black and white whenever it comes to religion back then as it is today. Like, today we can definitely decipher whether or not somebody is living due to religious means or whatever based on their intentions. But back then, whatever actions were performed mattered more than the intention. So if the intention was to please the gods, that didn't really matter at the time. It was more what people interpreted your actions to be, which is exactly what happened with this author. Outside of that, we also have the Necronomicon. So the Necronomicon, if you're a fan of H.P. Lovecraft, you know that it's actually supposed to be a fake, fictionalized grimoire that appears throughout his literature. But there is an actual version that was printed back in 1980. And it's also said to be written originally back in the 8th century, who knows, by a man named Abdul Alhared. And he's just called the Mad Arab, basically. It's said that this was written by, you know, Alhared in Damascus around the 8th century. And it's an artifact that's debated to be a part of the actual Sumerian culture itself. The book itself runs, it's said to run about 800 pages and hold formulae to evoke incredible things that are supposed to be just hidden from our world, like ancient gods, beings and monsters which dwell in the abyss, outer space, and even like functions of the human psyche that we're not supposed to have access to. This text references the Key of Solomon, the Book of Power, and a few other texts that are supposed to be like legendary for aiding sorcerers and rituals and dark magic. So a note on the Key of Solomon, it's one of the most powerful grimoires in the entire world and probably in all of history. It's like a two-volume work that attests to the continuity and changes that basically like happened whenever it came to the German magical literature throughout the late 17th to mid 18th century. And it's an example of the unique techniques and spiritualists that, well, not spiritualists, but spiritual list that circulated around the Holy Roman Empire. And all of those works basically consolidated into what we know as the Faustian tradition now, which is sort of like a cultish tradition based on Faustus. And we're going to get on that figure a little bit later in this presentation. But this book is also referenced as Goetia, or the Book of Evil Spirits. And it contains 200 diagrams and seals in regards to necromancy, witchcraft, black art, and ceremonial magic. So the Key of Solomon is one of the most remarkable works in history and influenced the work of Necronomicon holistically. It's important to look at both these works, I believe. But back to the Necronomicon. So if you can get a copy of that, I strongly recommend it. I have my own paperback copy, and it's only, like I'm looking at it right now, it's only like 200 something pages, and most of the text is fucking gibberish. But before the gibberish, there is a lot of information on the history of the Necronomicon and its connection to the Sumerian culture. And even if it's a huge conspiracy, it's really interesting to look at and interesting to learn, because whenever it comes to everything outside of necromancy, such as normal witchcraft, the intention of the ritual is the most important part of the magic, not necessarily the ritual itself. Having access to these books can be really helpful just in case you need to bring forth the ancient gods for any reason, just in case you need to bring the end of the world upon everybody else, you know, for any reason. I'm just putting that out there. That last but not least, considering this book is the most dangerous grimoire on the list, is called the Grand Grimoire, which is also known as the Gospel of Satan or the Red Dragon. It was discovered in the Tomb of Solomon in 1750, written in either Biblical Hebrew or Aramaic. It's still debated amongst scholars which language it is specifically, but the legends surrounding the Red Dragon revolve around the apocryphal writings by Honorius of Thebes, a man who claimed to be possessed by Satan himself. And the book had proof of demonic evocation and dark spells, obviously, as well as a thorough explanation of the process whereby newly elected popes may slowly be won over by Satan's greatness, which I think is pretty fucking cool. Not only that, but the book is known to be impervious to fire. And it's said that this four-part book is owned by the Roman Catholic Church and is kept in the Vatican secret archives, where it remains completely unavailable to the public. But it's also said that the Red Dragon is spread amongst practitioners of voodoo, especially in Haiti, to this day, where the text is called Le Véritable Dragon Rouge. I don't know. But according to all the research that me and my friends have been doing, it serves the basis for most of the necromantic rituals that we're going to be seeing later on. And also the book that you need whenever you perform the rituals that I will describe at the end of the episode. According to the Necronomicon, as well as many pagan religions that stemmed from the emergence of this practice in ancient times, there are two sets of gods in the mythos, and they are known as the Elder Gods, which there's not a lot revealed about these gods except for the fact that they're like a stellar race that comes to the rescue of man every so often. But the other sect of gods, they're called, like I've said a million times already, the Ancient Ones. There's a lot told about the, there's a ton of information given about these figures, mainly draping these figures in darkness. The Ancient Ones wish nothing but ill for the race of man, and they constantly strive to break into our world through some sort of gate or door that leads from the outside in. So this book may or may not be useful in terms of evoking ancient spirits, or if ancient spirits are even real, but a few things are for sure. Like, first of all, it is often believed in witchcraft, like I said before, that as long as the intention's there, like, the invocation doesn't necessarily matter. But the most important part about this is that if there's a need to evoke an ancient spirit or bring them into our realm, this goes to prove that the desire to communicate with incarnate beings is still prominent among our community of practicing magicians. And, you know, if you need an example of what an ancient god is, a popular example of this is, you know, the ancient god of Azazoth. He's a deity with countless tentacles and fangs. He basically just looks like a big, like, cupcake full of tentacles and teeth. And he floats in the air in the big abyss, and he's sleeping. And if he wakes, it's known to bring the end of the world, like basically the end of reality as we know it, because as he dreams, those dreams craft our reality. Like, we're basically living inside of that deity's head. So if you need any more reference as to how dangerous these ancient gods are, I would do some research on your own, because that alone scared the shit out of me, and it pushed me back from really researching some more at this time. However, though the documented history of notorious necromancers are few, there are a few figures that are famously depicted as necromancers in the past, you know, in literature and in the Bible. For example, the first is Dr. Johann Faust. He's also known as Dr. Faustus. And Faustus is a famous figure in German and biblical literature, since he was one of the first necromancers, or, you know, one of the first beings that gained power by trading his soul to the devil. And this stems back to Babylonian times as well, this legend, just because he learns how to conjure demons and he gains power from them, all because he conjured a spirit named Mephistopheles, who traveled to the underworld on Dr. Faustus's behalf to ask Satan if his soul can be traded for psychic superpowers. And Dr. Faust, he was granted 24 years of powers that allowed him to manipulate elements with little to no ritual accompaniment whatsoever. So even though he signed a contract to Satan with his blood, and the blood didn't fucking come out of his finger right the very first time, which is an actual thing, you can go ahead and look this up on YouTube. If you look up Dr. Faustus from the user Thug Life, like, or Thug History, that's what it is, you'll get an amazing story about Dr. Faustus told in a very compelling narrative. And you know what? I'm going to go ahead and give you a little preview on this video, because it does a good job at explaining the two different texts regarding Faustus, and how the legend is surrounded around him, you know, voluntarily giving his soul to the devil, but also being tricked into it. And this is the analysis broken down by, sorry, not Thug History. This is the official name, Thug Notes.
This player stirred up mad controversy over the years. Like I said earlier, there are actually two different versions of it, and ain't nobody know which one is the legit version. Scholars been all up on each other's nuts about it for years. The first one hit the scene in 1604, called the A-Tex, and the other dropped about 12 years later, called the B-Tex. Some cats think the A-Tex is messy, repetitive, and goofy as f*** compared to the B-Tex. Even though there's only about a 600-line difference between the two, peeps think that pretty much changes the whole game. Some thugs thinking that 600 lines are the difference between Faustus choosing to sell his own soul and being tricked into doing it. Like somebody pulling the strings. Since Faustus chooses damnation in Text 8, most of the suffering he beasting through is psychological. So all throughout the play, he going back and forth between rolling with the devil's crew or jumping ship and repping God's people. My heart's so hard and I cannot repent. Scarce can I name salvation, faith, or heaven. But fearful echoes thunder in mine ears. Faustus, thou art damned. But Faustus' offense can never be pardoned. The serpent that tempted Eve may be saved, but not Faustus. Sure, the B-Tex got plenty of that too. But it got a greater focus on that physical pain. That's why at the end of the B-Tex, Faustus don't just get carried away. Nah, blood, brother gets his ass towed up by demons. But the controversy don't stop there, sucker. Some scholars saying this is one of the most satanic dramas ever. Others think it's one of the most Christian. What? Others arguing about which denomination and often pulling in ideas of Calvinist predestination up in here. Predestination basically means that some hustlers are so legit that they are destined from day one to get into heaven, whereas everybody else is damned to hell for all eternity and there's nothing they can do about it. God's choice. That's right. So is Faustus condemned to hell because he acting out? Or is he acting out because he's condemned to hell? Is the play saying that you're going to get put in your place if you try to mess with God's laws? Or is it way more f***ed up than that?
So, yeah, as you can tell, the legend surrounding Faustus is very controversial. But it serves as a very important story in our literature. And he also serves as a very important figure in necromancy because, like it says here, he sold his soul to the devil just so he can get powers. And the legend stretches, like, in different directions based on the different texts that Faustus comes up in. But the most common one, and the one that I believe, is that he genuinely sold his cell on his, or excuse me, sold his soul on his own volition because he genuinely wanted those powers. But once the time came that he actually had to go fucking to hell, he did not like it. But at any rate, back to what I was saying, even though his blood didn't come out of his finger correctly the first time, he kept pushing, he kept fucking dragging that shit out of his finger, and eventually he signed that contract. So the moment that 24 years was over, his soul belonged to the devil, and it's the mystery around his death is vast. Like, we don't really know if he ended up dying at 24 or not, but yeah, that just goes to show that if you sell your soul to the devil, you get psychic superpowers. And I think we all kind of knew that, but it's kind of fun to just know for a fact that that was from our history, because obviously the Bible is historical. Another documented necromancer is the alchemist and alleged magician Edward Kelly. And he had his work expanded on within the pages of the Book of Black Magic by Arthur Edward Waite. That's a book that was published back in like 1910, all about dark magic and ceremonial magic and whatnot, and how to do these things correctly. But anyway, in this book, there's a depiction of Kelly with his companion named Paul Waring, the same man Kelly had assist him in like all of his conjurings. And the scene shows a churchyard near Walton-le-Dale. It's said to be in the country of Lancaster. And they're in the physical act of invoking the spirit of a deceased person. And that's really all I got on that guy. There's just a famous depiction of him, like, actually doing necromancy in the act. And there's several of these sorts of depictions in the Book of Black Magic. They're called plates. And if you're able to look through that, it's free. If you go on your, like, on Google Play or on the Apple Store, if you download the ebook. So if you want to go ahead and look at those, I would highly recommend it because it's pretty interesting and it helps you understand like the origins of necromancy and like the ideals around black magic and whatnot during this time period. Another figure I know of is Nibiros. He is famous in ancient Babylonian times, and he might be related to, like, the deities as well. I'm not completely sure about his history, but I do know that he is said to have the power to inflict evil on whoever he wants, and he discovered the Hand of Glory, which basically reveals every virtue of metals, minerals, vegetables, as well as all animals, pure and impure. He possessed the art of predicting things to come, so, you know, fortune telling. And he is known as one of the greatest greatest necromancers in all of the infernal hierarchies. He's a demon, but he appears to have like three heads that they're all dog heads. And then he's also depicted as a raven. So he has like bird's feet, but three dog heads. And it's fucking terrifying. And he has a rock, like a, I don't know how to describe his voice. It's sort of like the teacher from Jimmy Neutron. And he presents himself really eloquently though. And he teaches the art of gracious living, which is just terrifying to imagine because he's like graciously teaching you how to live while looking like a fucking like nightmare in the flesh. He appears in the Grand Grimoire as well. And he's depicted as like the Inspector General of the Armies of Hell, which is very contradictory compared to his mythological history, I guess, because, you know, he's supposed to teach the art of gracious living, but at least his appearance serves a purpose in the second like depiction in the Grand Grimoire. Because from what I'm seeing online is that the mythological view of him has been around a lot longer than the view that was depicted in the Grand Grimoire. So, depending on what you think he should stand for, I guess it depends on your perception of him. So, I don't know. But from what I can see, those are the few stories regarding him. And I just think that it's just kind of confusing and weird that he has powers to also bring back the dead. Because it says here that he teaches mystic and occult qualities of all animals, plants, and minerals, and he supplies necromantic advice as well. So, obviously, historically, like in modern times, there have always been necromancers and there always will be necromancers. So, now's the time to ask yourself, are you a potential necromancer? Are you someone who's looking to raise the dead? Are you someone who wants to tell the future or potentially find some hidden fucking treasure, just like that guy that hid his treasure in New Mexico? Are you looking for that by way of necromancy? Because if you are, I've got the fucking solution for you. At least in terms of an infernal spirit or somebody familiar to you or somebody who committed suicide. Anyway, I don't openly, like, condone this practice again, like I said, and I'm just joking, but I highly recommend that you try to communicate with the dead through a safer venue if you need to, because I understand the curiosity wrapped around this subject, and it's really dangerous. I just believe that doing a different ritual would be better if you want to communicate with the dead, but for academic purposes, I will give you two genuine rituals that can be found in the Book of Black Magic. I only feel safe actually telling these things out loud because I'm not actually practicing the ritual itself. I'm just describing it. So just putting that out there. If you're listening to this, do not be frightened, because as long as you're not performing the actual rite of necromancy and whatnot, you will be okay. Well, if any of your answers are yes to these questions, I just want to go ahead and put out a disclaimer that I don't openly condone the practice of necromancy. However, I looked all of this up just for the sake of knowing this information. And I know most of you guys listening are just trying to get information as well whenever it comes to the practice of necromancy. However, if you do go about actually practicing these things, if you do end up purchasing the few books that were mentioned in this podcast, if you do anything that actually cements this action into the world, please, please, please be aware that I don't condone it, first of all. And second of all, necromancy is illegal. So getting caught in these actions, you will get arrested. And last but not least, you do need to be safe, because at any point of time, whenever you're communicating with the other realm, your soul is completely open to manipulation by those other spirits as well. So protect yourself. Make sure that you have all the amulets and the protective like measures that you need, like having a circle around you. Just, you know, just have everything in place if you do end up practicing this ritual. And please do not do anything dangerous to hurt somebody else or yourself. Anyway, now that we got that out of the way, let's remember that the practitioner that tries to bring about the dead needs to have a thorough understanding of the person that they're trying to bring back, as well as like the actual ritual that coincides with your relation to that individual as well. So if it's a distant individual, do your due diligence and do the research, learn about them, everything. If it's somebody close to you, you already know them. So meditate on what you know about them and everything that you know about their prerogative while they were alive, not based on your perception of them. Try to get into their mindset about who they believed they were internally, like their self-image. Anyway, those measures that we take before the ritual, we already mentioned beforehand. So let's get right into it. According to the Book of Black Magic, the practitioner must do a few things while using the red dragon to properly raise infernal or familiar spirits. This ritual is only for infernal or familiar spirits. That's it. It's not for finding treasure. It's not for suicidal spirits. It's not for literally like fucking Tom Cruise. It's only for people that you know, or other gods or devils that exist only in the ethereal realm and have never been a human before. So the first thing is that you need to bring the dead to a familiar location in order to bring a special alliance with the soul and the body back into fruition. And this can be either at their home, a place the person used to frequent all the time, a place where a special event happened in that person's life, or best of all, the place where they actually died. Places where ceremonial like aspects took place, such as like baptisms or birthdays or like weddings, those are also really special. However, the biggest one is the place where the person actually died, because the dead being brought to their place of death is known to be the most powerful places to reanimate the being, as this is where they're connected the most. Death brings about so much ambiguity whenever it comes to the spirit crossing over that the connection is very strong whenever the individual is brought back to the place where they've died. And once they're reanimated, they may start relaying information from that incident in particular if they weren't put to rest properly or if they died abruptly. So that is something to be prepared for. Outside of that, churchyards, gibbets, and battlefields are really popular places to reanimate the dead as well, mainly because, like for battlefields, for example, the souls of soldiers are said to haunt any battlefield and are said to be the most ideal places to summon the dead if you don't have anywhere else to go, mainly because there's a high chance of success considering the amount of death that happens on that ground. There have been a bunch of stories of people like sloshing through inches of blood and whatnot whenever they're going through battle. That's more metaphorical, or like just so that we can get a symbol of how many people died. But that symbol in itself residing in a battlefield and gibbets give the practitioner a big, I guess, like an advantage whenever they're bringing forth the dead. The same for churchyards, because in churchyards, it's holy, but there are obviously dead people in the ground. It's pretty much the same as a battlefield, except there are actual bodies there. One must have proper tools for the ritual. Examples of such are the corpse or a spoonful of flesh, a ceremonial knife with a black handle, a wand, architrave, a hook, and a staff, a lancet, and even the sword of an assistant, if an assistant is present. So if you do have an assistant, make sure that they have their own tools as well, because they're a part of the ceremony as much as you are. To raise the ghost or an apparition of a familiar entity or by an infernal spirit, the magician along with the assistant must repair the churchyard or tomb where the deceased was buried exactly at midnight, as a ceremony can only be performed in the night between the hours of 12 and 1. The grave is first to be opened, or at least an aperture must be made where access may be had to the naked body. So another important thing to remember is that whenever you're conjuring the dead, you need to protect yourself. You need to have amulets that are used for protection, and you also need to have a circle. So when creating a circle of protection, which is necessary whenever you're doing a necromancy ritual, it is common to do a circle of salt accompanied with jars of salt water in four even places, mainly because this is safe, this is effective, and it works every time. So why use salt water? Water is symbolic of purity, and salt is symbolic of life. So having both salt and water alone are fine, but having them combined, especially in a ritual like bringing people back to life, is said to remind the likes of the fallen angels and evil spirits of the purity and power of God and the fucking floods that he sent to cleanse our world of all these filthy, filthy, unclean spirits. However, if you're feeling a little experimental, here's another way to create a circle of protection, but you must follow it to a T or else you won't be protected. So, out of the Book of Black Magic, this circle states that it's formed out of the skin of the victim, fastened to the ground by four nails taken from the coffin of an executed criminal. The skull is that of parricide, which basically means murder a parrot. Just kidding. It just means that you cut the head off of your fucking mom or dad. The horns of those of a goat, and there must be a male bat opposite the skull that was drowned in blood. The bat was drowned in blood, not the skull. And then there must be a black cat whose head forms the fourth object in the circumference of the circle, and it must have fed on human flesh. Without all of these stipulations met, there's no guarantee that you'll actually be safe. So be careful, but also, it's pretty fucking metal. I guess there's no real way to be careful when you're that fucking metal. So once the magician describes the circle, holds his magic wand in his right hand, while his companion holds a consecrated torch, the magician turns himself to all four winds and, touching the dead body three times with the magical wand, repeats as follows.
By the virtue of holy resurrection and the torments of the damned, I conjure and exorcise thee, spirits of in, deceased, to answer my liege demands, being obedient unto these sacred ceremonies, on pain of everlasting torment and distress, Beryl, Belblin, God, Kabir, Abigail, arise, I charge and command thee.
After these steps are completed, the ghost or apparition will become visible and will answer any questions put forth by the necromancer. If the desired spirit was one that was subject to suicide, though, the conjuration must be performed while the body lies on the spot where it is first found after the suicide was committed. Then, the practitioner will bind the top of his wand with a bundle of St. John's wort and the head of an owl. So just in case you guys are confused, St. John's wort was believed to be a divine herb, and some even said that its sap is identical to the tears or the blood of the Virgin or, you know, Mary. The violet sap, which is retrieved from squeezing the flower buds, was used specifically for enchanting, and in regards to, like, the owls and whatnot in Celtic mythology, they were known to know their way around the underworld, and they were fierce defenders of truth and honor. So owls have no tolerance for deception, and they're known to connect to like clairvoyance and astral projection specifically. So in terms of necromancy, having an owl's head during the ritual is very, very useful and powerful and could help guide the spirit to your realm much easier. Mainly because they're using the assistance of the owl to do that. So once the practitioner repairs the spot where the corpse lies, for the sake of this ritual, we're going to pretend that the individual hung themselves so that you can get a better idea of how this is done. It must be done at 12 o'clock at night. And once he draws the circle, laying down that fucking sweet fucking flesh on the ground, he solemnly repeats these words. The mysteries of the deep, by the flames of Benal, by the power of the east and the silence of the night, by the holy rites of the hectic, I conjure and exorcise thee, thou distressed spirit, to present thyself here and reveal unto me the cause of thy calamity, while doubts did offer violence to thou own liege life, where thou art now in being, and where thou wilt hereafter be. After you say that very beautifully written passage, you gently smite the carcass 9 times with the rod. You just fucking gently smack it a little bit. 9 times. And then the conjurer adds,
I conjure thee, thou spirit of indecision, answer my defense, and I propound unto thee, as though ever hope is the rest of the holy ones, and ease of all thy misery, by the blood of Jesus, which he shed for thy soul, I conjure and bind thee to utter unto me what I shall ask of thee.
Then, after cutting the carcass from the tree, the necromancer and his assistant should lay the body so that the head is facing towards the east. And the necromancer must continue to repeat the incantation. And they should also set a chafing dish of fire at the deceased's right hand. And into that, they're going to be pouring a little bit of wine, some mastic, some gum aromatic, and the contents of a vial full of the sweetest oil. That could be legitimately anything. I don't know what the fuck the Book of Black Magic is referring to whenever it comes to sweet oil. But I don't know. Just some sweet fucking oil. Just put a whole vial of that in there. And the necromancer shall also have a pair of bellows and some unkindled charcoal to make fire burn bright when the carcass arises. The conjuration for this part of the ceremony is this.
I conjure thee, thou spirit of N, thou do not immediately enter in thy ancient body again and answer to my demands by the virtue of the holy resurrection and by the posture of the body of the savior of the world. I charge thee, I conjure thee, I command thee on pain of the torments and wandering of thrice 7 years, which I, by the force of sacred magical rites, have power to inflict upon thee by these sighs and groans. I conjure thee to utter thy voice. So help thee, God, in prayers of the Holy Church. Amen.
One possible addition to the ritual is having sex with the corpse, because it is also documented, not that I'm saying that you should. I'm not saying that you should, but I'm just saying that it is documented that a lot of necromancers practice having sex with the corpse so that, like, once their, you know, their sperm or whatever goes into their body, that is supposed to help the spirit, like, connect with the necromancer because of the fluids and whatnot. And also that's supposed to help the body know what the necromancer is trying to get out of them, like basically transferring their knowledge through the semen into their body. And I'm not exactly sure if this is the correct ideology behind having sex with the corpse. It could just be to, like, fucking have sex with the corpse, but from what was documented, it seems more spiritual than that, and it seems like it ties the necromancer to the body more than just meditating on the individual's life. So this ceremony needs to be repeated 3 times, all while the fire is burning with mastic and gum aromatic. While this is all happening, the body will start to slowly rise, and at last it will stand up front before the actual practitioner, answering with faint and hollow voice the questions propounded to it, such as why it destroyed itself, where it is dwelling, what food and life are, how long it will be here, and by what means the magician may actually assist it to come to rest. Also, the spirits are known to come forth with their knowledge of treasures in this world and where they're hidden. The spirit can also answer very punctually concerning the places where ghosts reside and of the manner of communicating with them, teaching the nature of astral spirits and hellish beings to humans so far as the spirit's capacity allows. When the ghost fully answers, the magician, out of complete commiseration and reverence to the deceased, must do everything they can to put the actual spirit to rest. If the spirit's not put to rest, a whole shit ton of stuff can happen. Like, you think saying goodbye on a Ouija board is bad? This is fucking bad. Like, you can actually die if you don't put the spirit back to rest. And it makes sense because if I was brought back to life and I just had to answer your dumbass questions and then you didn't even let me go back to what I was doing before, I'd be pretty pissed and I'd probably end up killing you because I have nothing better to do and I'm stuck there. So, in order to properly put the spirit to rest, this is what you need to do. This is what is recommended in the Book of Black Magic. You can simply just dig a grave, fill it halfway with quick lime, a little salt, and common sulfur, and then just lay the naked carcass on top of that. It's pretty easy. Just fucking dig a grave. In this and all cases where ghosts or apparitions of the deceased persons are, you know, risen or they're consulted for any reason, great caution needs to be observed by the magician to keep close and stay within the circle. If you step out of the circle of protection, like at any moment, even if it's just like your limbs or whatever, just like kind of like leaning out, there's always potential for something horrible to happen. And by horrible, I mean there's potential that your soul can literally get fucking demolished. And it's pretty fucking terrifying how easy this can happen. It explicitly states in the Book of Black Magic, "For if he be in the predicament of those who follow the black art for iniquitous purposes, it is very dangerous to conjure any spirits without describing the form of the circle and wearing the pentacle of Solomon upon either hand or heart. The ghosts of men deceased can easily effect sudden death on the magician born under such a constellation of the planets, even whilst in the act of being exorcised. So every precaution to save the necromancer's soul must be put into place, or else the practitioner could potentially die." Okay. After any necromancy ritual is done, necromancers must burn the body of the spirit they raised, or else the practitioner also runs the risk of having their body taken over, because that's the only way to properly put the soul back to rest as well. Having a proper burial for them, it's like basically doing the whole entire funeral thing all over again for them, and then setting their soul on fire sets them free. Now that we got through all of that, I have some moral questions regarding this practice. Like, is it morally acceptable to practice necromancy for the sake of communication, such as the course of action taken by those who practice white magic? Like, what do you guys think? It'd be really cool if you guys could just let me know what you think in regards to this, because personally, I think that necromancy taken in the form of white magic isn't dangerous, and it seems to be culturally acceptable. However, it's illegal, so I can't completely endorse it. But if it wasn't illegal and I could endorse it, I would probably maybe say that it isn't not okay to do. And secondarily, what scenarios warrant ethical, permissible circumstances to perform a necromancy ritual? So if somebody in your life just died, like your mom or your sister and whatnot, is it ethically permissible to bring them back to life? The answer to this question is fuck no. don't do it. Like, don't fucking try. But if you're using necromancy for the purposes of, you know, evoking a spirit because you need the spirit to, like, help you in some sort of way, then obviously, like we've been saying this whole time, it's illegal. But I would find that that is more ethically permissible than just bringing about somebody willy-nilly for no fucking reason. Like, if you need answers for something, that's ethically permissible. Excuse me, that's ethically permissible. Or if you need, like, some sort of guidance because there's, like, a fucking crisis going on and need answers for the future. Even though, you know, Plato and, like, Aristotle, all of those philosophers would beg to differ with me, I would say that having access to the future isn't, like, natural, but it is something that we can get access to in emergency circumstances. So if it's an emergency and you absolutely need information regarding the future, then I would say that it is not okay to do necromancy ritual for that sake. However, just so that nobody fucking sues me or says anything or tries to fucking punish me in any sort of way, I do not condone necromancy. I just want you guys to know how fucking awesome necromancy's history is. So remember, if you're grieving for any sort of reason, necromancy might not be the answer for you. Sometimes you just need a big ugly ass cry on the shower floor with a big bag of wine. Or maybe you need to play with the Ouija board for a little bit. You know, Hasbro made so many of those. You could just play around with that and, like, go get it from Walmart or something. Sure, it's dangerous, but it's a lot safer, arguably, than necromancy. Well, that basically sums up all the information that my friend Hunter and I got on this, as well as Justin. He sent us so many different, like, books that we were able to look at, which was super fucking helpful. I hope that this was helpful. I'm not sure if it was, but this is only the first part of the Back to Life series. Next time, we're going to be talking more about the reanimation of corpses from different routes. So get prepared to hear a lot about voodoo and reanimating corpses through electricity and weird shit with science. There's a bunch of shit that goes on with bringing Ted back to life and also connecting with zombies and whatnot. It's going to be really fucking cool over the next couple episodes. I definitely recommend you stay tuned with this series in particular. But like I said earlier on in the episode, we will come back to Japanese shit and all a bunch of other stuff outside of these realms later on too. So in the next couple weeks, there's going to be a lot of shit that we're going to be talking about. In the meantime, please be safe, don't get infected, don't fucking die, and please be sure to feed your black cat some sweet, sweet human flesh before putting it into your circle of protection. Salutations, bitches!